Well, I heard there was a secret chord that David played, and it pleased the Lord. But you don't really care for music, do you?
The problem hadn't been that nobody cared. They may not have cared enough, and they may not have cared about all the things that he cared about. But did anyone not want their children to grow up in a world that was safe, healthy, gorgeous, fun, kind, generous, bold, fair, prosperous, and sustainable? Or to be recognised for those qualities in their own lives? He'd been having the fun, gorgeous, generous conversation for as long as he could remember. Whenever he did, conservatives and liberals alike usually smiled and nodded. And at some stage in almost every meeting he had chaired or been part of, and there had been many meetings, meetings of school committees, Harry and Athletic Club committees, Friends of the Haven, Harbour Watch, the Community Gardens, Arts Council, City Council, Values Party, Green Party, Alliance meetings, and parliamentary select committees. And at some stage during most of them, he would remind folk of why they were doing what they were doing and ask perhaps, to what end? To what end? The to what end speech was about the big picture. It didn't matter whether they'd been deliberating school finances, organising events, discussing transport or housing policy, saving forests or whales, or legislating in the House. The to what end speech was a reminder about the things we could all agree on, the stuff with the capacity to unite us. It was the to what end speeches and the more gorgeous, fun, generous mantra that made the eyes light up. And then he thought it had been when he reminded his audiences of how far we had come and how he believed if anyone could get it right, it was us. That even the most rabid conservatives had smiled and nodded, told him he needed to contest a mayoralty, that they couldn't disagree with him. It was when he forgot that as a rare and a highly principled individual who will let the evidence get in the way of a strongly held opinion and focused on the frequently very big details about the things he disagreed with, that they stopped listening to one another and lost sight of the common ground. When his allies argued that sometimes you just had to tell people they were wrong, he'd reply, only if it makes a difference. For it matters how little convincing our arguments may be. Telling people the things they believe passionately in are wrong may make us feel good and our supporters cheer, but it's unlikely ever to convince our opponents and more frequently polarizes and demonizes the very people we most need to talk to and their supporters and accentuates the differences. When being right and proving our opponents wrong matters more than making good decisions, arriving at outcomes satisfying to everyone is unlikely. It was Edward de Bono who had written, "No one is entirely right and no one is entirely wrong." The challenge is making the effort to understand why people who are unlikely to disagree with us when we focus on the big picture are so disagreeable when we plan or oppose plans to build another highway or persist in holding views different than our own. On climate change, fluoridating the water supply, or who killed John Kennedy. Sometimes it may not be possible to find the common ground, but agreeing to disagree is likely to be far less disagreeable when we are prepared to recognize that others are as sincerely motivated in their beliefs as we are in ours, and switching the subject to initiatives on which we can agree is likely to be far more productive. It had been the elderly liberal who had suggested to a city's transport strategy committee that if a new highway into the city was ever needed, that the designated and most controversial route is where it should go. He had also pointed out that since advice was that traffic volumes were unlikely to justify another highway for at least 30 years, there were a range of measures they could implement in the interim to enable people to move freely around their city. The committee had agreed, but the controversy had only gone away when opponents to the proposed highway had agreed that the highway supporters weren't a bunch of Neolithic petrol heads, and that while the delays might not have been anything like those experienced in other cities, any delays were unacceptable, and that heavy traffic around the iconic waterfront was a problem, and that both sides then had started to talk to one another. Active transport uptake, people walking and cycling and bus patronage had burgeoned. The waterfront had become dramatically safer and quieter, and peak traffic flows and the subsidies paid to public transport operators had been slashed. It had taken some years to establish a rail link to the inland port on the plains and to build the additional processing capacity necessary to turn the high volumes of Pinus radiata into high-value products and reduce the volumes of unprocessed, low-value timber travelling to and across the port. But long before that, collaborative arrangements with a very obliging heavy transport industry, combined with advances in engine technology and highway construction, and modest changes to speed limits, combined with the traffic volumes being reduced and the completion of the shared waterfront promenade, transformed the experiences of living on and travelling along the city's iconic waterfront. Changing the culture had been remarkably simple and surprisingly undraconian. The incentives had been modest, but beginning with the knowledge that traffic moved more freely during school holidays, schools built travel smart initiatives into their Enviro Schools program. Students worked out how much energy it took driving children to and from school and calculated what the savings might be if the entire schools could be persuaded to walk, cycle, or catch the bus. The education sector calculated the savings in money and the time saved commuting if numbers being driven to their studies each day could be halved, and the council agreed to dedicate a minuscule portion of the savings to creating safe travel plans for schools and rewarding individuals and schools for their successes. While wet days could still be a problem, the problems were much less problematic, and the numbers getting to school under their own steam quickly outstripped even the most ambitious predictions. More controversial had been the decision to make the first hour's parking in the city free. The elderly Liberal had been criticised for seconding the Mayor's motion implementing the measure, but he'd long been averse to punishment, and while the common wisdom dictated that making parking more expensive was key to discouraging folk from bringing their cars to town, he'd observed that all the big cities had seriously demanding traffic issues in spite of dramatically higher parking charges than in his own wee city. The critics had said that the Nelson people wouldn't catch buses. But they had. But buses had been just one part in the transport culture shift jigsaw. Once again, it had taken a collaborative effort. The city's business had shown a remarkable willingness to incentivise staff and management to fill the buses, travel with friends and family, or walk and cycle when they could. And it had been the businesses who had pointed out, when driving to work was the only sensible option, it wasn't in anyone's interest to park in car parks best reserved for their customers. Once again, council, public transport operators and local businesses had provided a range of incentives, from priority parking for carpoolers to spot prizes for bus patrons and walkers and cyclists. But it had been the council's real-time billboards showing the decline in traffic volumes, travel times and carbon emissions and the increase in motor car occupancy rates that let people know they were making a difference, and the stories in the local media about the individual savings and experiences of thinking differently about where, when and how and whether they travelled that were the best culture change drivers. Council had paid to decorate the insides and the outsides of the buses and compensated the bus companies for their loss of advertising revenue. The Brook bus became the Sanctuary bus, emblazoned with images of backpacker and bushwalk and bird and tiny beast and stream and waterfall. The Tahuna bus featured beach, boats, waterfront cafe and bar and suntanned bodies. And on the bus to and from the city? Pictures of people. People at outdoor cafe and bar on tree-lined street with flower basket and street stall. And inside the buses, pictures, prose and upholstery to die for. In spite of the successes, not everyone had been convinced. But it is never necessary to change everyone's mind to make good things happen. Cleaner air, safer roads, reduced travel times and slashing the very considerable transport component of the City Council's rates, plus the personal savings, had been sufficient to convince the overwhelming majority that they were, indeed, onto a good thing. The knowledge that they were setting the standard for the rest of the country also had its own appeal. It had been the transport leadership that had turned the overwhelming majority into willing partners in the city's other innovative initiatives. They appreciated the fairness of the process, that they'd been listened to, and that if a further road into the city were ever needed, that it remained an option. But mostly, they just liked the idea of being seen as leaders. The Creative Alliance had worked a similar magic in Parliament. He hadn't been nearly so effective the first time around. He'd arrived 2 weeks after Election Day, courtesy of the special votes, with just one goal, to change the way his party did business. He wanted to be in government, and thought he knew what it would take to get there. But his had been a minority view and a caucus of very dedicated, single-minded and passionate colleagues. In spite of a gift of a gab that others told him was inspirational and a former Hansard recorder had said was up there with the best of them, his plea for more optimism, urgency and collaboration had been ineffective, and ineptly delivered, perhaps. The media staff said that the cameras liked him and that they needed to get him on the box more often. But they hadn't, and while it was tempting to blame his low-profile portfolios, waste, tourism, old people, arts and culture, sport and small business, his television appearances had been infrequent and were as often as not for putting his foot in it. He hadn't liked giving others a hard time, believed that the media were impartial and the journalists were interested in all things newsworthy, the good and the bad. But his attempts at being outrageous, quirky and innovative went to the press gallery via the party's media staff, who believed that the media were only interested in the negative and made strenuous efforts to add the barb and the borax to his attempts at differently newsworthy press releases. And not unsurprisingly, the press gallery found little newsworthy in an old opposition MP giving a hard time to ministers, most of whom he had a soft spot for. But the Creative Alliance had been willing to listen, and it had had the numbers. It also benefited from the Oldly Liberals' years of experience when shaping its highly successful parliamentary culture shifting strategy. While its members were still capable of getting it wrong, the focus on the vision and collaboration and the find no fault mantra had been hardwired into the party's ethos. The first rule of getting it wrong was to admit that you got it wrong. And if you weren't certain you'd got it wrong, the very least you could do was to ask had you got it wrong, thank your critics for being so helpful, and to apologise while you went off and checked. His experience had taught him that it is useful to remember when talking publicly to or about other politicians or anyone else with views different to our own, that we're also talking to their supporters and giving the person they may very well have voted for or have some sympathy with a hard time, or failing to address the concerns of others whose views may share is not a great strategy for being listened to or for winning over someone else's constituents. The Oldly Liberal had observed that while politicians may from time to time say things that aren't true and fudge issues, lying involves knowingly saying things that aren't true and is far more unusual. And reminding others of their shortcomings is a shortcut to confrontation and undermines communications. Collaborating with those with a different view simply requires a different level of diplomacy. But the culture had changed. And no one had been more surprised than the Oldly Liberal at the speed with which their parliament became an icon of civility and a most enlightened collaborative role model in a world desperately in need of civility and enlightened role models.
It's not a cry that you hear at night, and it's not somebody who's seen the light. It's a cold and it's a broken hallelujah.